Hi, everybody. My name's Jeff DeMarc.
And I'm Allie Friedland. And give it up for the Randalls LeBeau Amarcon Trio.
Welcome to The Word, a community storytelling project of the Arcata Playhouse and KHSU Public Radio.
And we'd like to dedicate this evening's performances to Dan O'Gara, who was really a profound storyteller with all his long-term love of bringing storytelling to this community.
The theme our storytellers have been asked to explore is being in community.
It has been my pleasure to actually facilitate workshops that worked on personal stories with people.
And we were helped by fellow storytellers Paul Woodland and Charlene Storr, and we briefly coached interested peoples of the community on the development of their stories the past few weeks.
So our very first storyteller is Jan Bramlett, and the title of her story is First Day of School.
I wasn't used to the cold up north. It was chilly in September. My brother had come up the year before to stay with my mama's people, so he was already like a New Yorker. I miss my daddy. He used to make fun of my brother, talking like a Yankee. I miss him and my cousins. They are so far away now. Well, my mama told me she was going to take me to school on PS 147, 5 blocks from our house, but she couldn't get the time off from work. Mama was a waitress. She had to work every day, make enough money for us to live on. Well, my brother, he's in sixth grade. He was going to take me. That was good because he knew the way. He stayed with my grandma and grandpa when mama went back with daddy that last time. He didn't want to be hit no more. Well, we started out that day walking straight up that big street, him and me. And there was all these houses all looking the same. I had never been down that far before. And I was watching the sidewalks because they was all poking up everywhere. Like, you know, the trees get under there and lift up them big old cement squares right out of the ground. Well, they say step on the crack, break your mama's back. Well, I was just trying not to mess up my new shoes. And there was one spot in the sidewalk, it was sticking up like the pointy side of a house. And I had to step right around, clear around that spot. I was looking at all the different trees so I could try and remember how to get back to the house that day. And there was this one big black tree, like had these green spiky balls almost hit Brucey in the head. They didn't have trees like that in Memphis. Well, we came around this corner, and there was this big red brick building. It was so big, it was higher than the trees. And it had these big old windows with cages on them and this big set of stairs. And we walked up these steps, and my brother was pulling me up behind him. I remember I had a hard time keeping up with him. But I could hardly reach the handle when we walked in them big doors. I was glad Brucey was there with me. These grown-ups started asking us where we was going. Well, Brucey, he pushed right on through all them kids, running every which way like they was late for supper. And he walked right up to this boy who was standing in front of these two big closed doors like he owned them. And this boy had a plastic yellow thing around his chest, and come to find out later, he was a guard. Well, Brucey starts in through one of them doors, and that boy puts his hand up, and he says, "Stop! You can't go in here." Wow, uh-oh. I just looked at Brucey, and he said, "This is my sister, and I have to take her to her first grade class." Now, this boy was mean. I could see that. And he said to my brother, "You can't go in there because you're not in first grade, and you're not in second grade, and only first and second graders can go in through this hole." Well, Brucey looked mad. Now, Brucey, he was big, but that boy, he was bigger. And I was kind of worried about a fight coming on because it didn't look good. Well, Brucey, he started out going around that boy's shoulder, getting through that door. And that boy, he put up his right arm and he smacked Brucey and he pushed him back against the door real hard, against the wall. I was just sitting there looking at them. Well, I don't know what happened next or how I got on the other side of them heavy doors, but there I was in this big, long hallway, and there was these big doors on both sides made of wood with windows in them, and it was like a castle or something, and there was nobody there, and there was no Brucie, just me by myself. Well, I didn't know where to go, so I started walking. I went up to one of them doors, and there was a bunch of kids at tables and some lady standing in front. She was talking real loud. And I went over to the other side and looked in there and looked at the same kids and same tables, different lady. Well, I was standing there, and I saw so many of them doors, I didn't have no idea which one I was supposed to go in. And I knew that kid back there, he probably wasn't going to let me out the same way I came in. So I was stuck in there. And I got real scared. I was fixing to cry. I couldn't move. I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I just started to cry. I didn't know what to do, and there wasn't nobody to help me. Except this little lady, looking like a little doll. She was kind of funny looking. She had all squinty eyes, and she was walking over to me. Oh, she was talking to me. I couldn't understand these people in New York. They all talk so fast. Oh, she was wanting to know my name. I told her, Jeanette Bramlett. My mama told me to say Jeanette. Nobody never called me Jeanette. Well, she took my hand, that lady, and I reckon I better go with her because she seemed to know. So she drug me over to that one door, said something, and then she drug me on over to another door, and then she drug me all the way clear down the end of that hallway and went in that last door and pulled me in behind her. And there was this lady with white hair, looking a little like my grandma. And she said, "Hello, dear. My name is Miss Croak." Well, Miss Croak took my hand, and that other lady, she took off. I never did know her name. Well, these kids were in kindergarten, and they were in first grade, but they'd been in kindergarten together, and I hadn't been there because my mom and daddy moved around that year. And school in New York had started way before I ever left Memphis. So these kids all knew each other, and they all talked funny, too. Well, Ms. Croak, she put her arm on my shoulder, and she said, "Now, why don't you go up to the front of the room and introduce yourself to the class?" And I was mighty scared, but I finally stopped crying because it looked like I was supposed to be there. And I said, "Okay," I walk up in between them tables, and I got up to the front of the room by that blackboard, and I turned around and looked out at all them kids, and they all looking back at me, and there wasn't a sound in that room. And I opened my mouth, and I said, "Hi, y'all, my name is Jeanette Bramlett, and I'm from Memphis, Tennessee." And them kids, they commenced to laughing, every last one of them. They would just thought I was the funniest thing. Well, Ms. Croak told me to go sit down in an empty seat next to Louis Yersak. Come to find out, he thought he was my boyfriend. And there was three girls in that class named Susan, and two of them lived down my street. Well, after school that day, we walked home together, and we was laughing and skipping and cutting up, and I didn't even have to pay no attention to them sidewalks. Them girls, they knew the way.
And our next storyteller is Gail Pascoe. And the title of her story is My Mother's Stories.
When I was a little girl, quite often at bedtime, Mom would tell us stories. I loved to hear her voice. She'd raise her voice up and down, louder and softer. She'd pause at just the right moment to put some excitement into the story. And best of all is that when she'd read all the books in the house, all the childhood books, then she'd make up a story. And they were the best of all. I'd like to share one of those with you tonight. And it starts with the little girl is peering in the window of the bakery. There's so much frost on the window, she has to scrape it off so she can see in more. And she looks in and sees, oh my gosh, there's cases filled with cookies, chocolate chip and peanut butter, snickerdoodles and oatmeal and raisin. And then she sees donuts. Oh my gosh, there's glazes on the donuts and colored sprinkles. And then eclairs with chocolate oozing down the sides. Her stomach is cramping and she's so hungry. Her feet are also so cold and her fingertips, but she keeps looking inside that window. And she looks further and sees the very best of all, bread. All different sizes of loaves and shapes and rolls and biscuits, but oh, that bread. She can just imagine herself having a big slice of that bread with butter on it and just filling herself with that. And as she's looking in there, her feet get colder and colder, and there's ice and snow and mud, everything caked on, so she stomps her feet real loud. Then she hears a voice say, "Hey, you!" from inside. She jumps back, and she's startled, and she turns and runs into the street. And just then a car is sliding down the street, sideways now because it's trying to break on the ice to avoid hitting her. Suddenly a strong arm comes around her waist and pulls her up and back onto the sidewalk. Her arms and legs and this other person's arms and legs are flailing and they're sliding on the ice. And then before you know it, more arms and legs are flailing as the family has come out of the bakery and they're trying to help them up off the sidewalk. They shepherd them inside and they sit her down on a little chair and give her a hot mug of cocoa. Oh, it's steaming and hot and it feels so good. People start saying, "Well, who are you? Where are you from? What's your name? Where are your parents?" Her teeth are chattering, her lips are numb and chapped, and she can't even talk. Then a kind lady puts a wrap around her, a nice warm blanket. And she starts to kind of defrost. Her fingers start hurting and her toes because it's so warm. Now they almost feel worse. She looks at these people and they're so kind. And they're being so good to her. And she starts to cry. Because just hours before, she was in a home with a lot of other children. And they were all not cared for very well. They were all kind of dirty and cold quite often, not enough blankets on them, not enough food. And earlier that night, she had decided she was going to leave there. So she'd got her pillowcase and put her few prized possessions in it, a little hard piece of candy from the welfare worker, a sweater from one of her friends there. And even though it didn't fit her, it was a gift. She stuffed that in there. And then the doll that she'd found last week in a dumpster. It didn't matter where she got it. It was the only doll she'd ever had. She put that in there too and started out the back door with her little bag of treasures. Somebody yelled, "Where are you going? You can't leave. Come back here." She got so scared she dropped her pillowcase, left her treasures, and just ran out the back, down an alley and left and right different streets and just kept running and running and then... There was no one chasing her. She didn't hear her name being called. She didn't hear footsteps running after her. There was no one. Lights were coming on now in the city, and homes were being lit. People were coming home for the evening. She walked on and came across one home that looked really pretty, and she could see in the front window that a family was just sitting down for dinner. The father was standing at the head of the table and he was carving a nice roast. Mama was passing around bowls of vegetables and potatoes. And two kids were sitting there. The little boy reached over and pulled the pigtail of the little girl. She punched him in the arm, and then they laughed. And then she saw on that table was bread. Oh, and her stomach was growling. She loved bread. It would fill her. She knew it would fill her. She turned away from the window, but thought with such a yearning, if I could just be part of a family, have a mother, be somebody's sister. She kept walking, partly because she smelled bread baking. It kind of drew her to that bakery, where now she sat with her mug of cocoa and the blanket around her. That family was so kind, and they said, come with us, and they took her upstairs where they lived. She walked in there, and things were clean and shiny and smelled so good, and food was cooking, and people were happy, and the older sister took her into a bathtub, and she got a bubble bath. Oh, my gosh, bubble bath, and gave her a great big bar of soap that smelled like springtime. After that wonderful warming bath that smelled so good, she got out and the sister gave her some clothes to wear. They were too big on her, but, you know, they were clean and they were warm and soft. And they were so pretty. She'd never had anything so pretty, all the different colors on the sweater. Then they walked out into the dining room. And she couldn't believe it. There was a huge turkey on the table. It was browned on top and glistening. A big bowl of mashed potatoes with butter and gravy and beans and cranberry sauce and, oh, a basket of bread. It was steaming. It was still so hot from the oven. That's really all she wanted. She sat down at the table, and she did eat some turkey, and she did have some mashed potatoes, but boy, did she have bread. And more bread, and butter on that hot bread. Pretty soon, that stomach ache she'd had was a different kind of ache because she was so full. Her eyes started to get sleepy, and she was nodding and very tired. The daddy picked her up gently and took her back, laid her onto a soft bed that was had clean sheets and a nice warm blanket. He kind of tucked her in, and as she put her head down on the pillow, she realized how very full she felt, how very happy she felt, how very safe she felt. Now, my mother's been gone a long time, and obviously I'm not a child anymore. But every time I think of these stories, it all comes back to me. Thank you.
I could use a slice of bread right now. So another project member of The Word is Lauren Axelrod, and she went to hear the stories from the residents at Timber Ridge. Those residents were unable to make it here tonight because of travel and health reasons, but she, with the help of Tim Gray, were able to really capture some nuggets from these residents. So interspersed throughout the evening, there will be some audio recordings from the residents of Timber Ridge. And without further ado, here's our first one.
Hey, my name is Jody Rowland. When I got out of high school, I couldn't afford to go to college. I didn't want to stay at my job that I had all through high school, so I joined the Navy. When I decided to join the Navy, I told my mom and my stepdad. And my stepdad was irate. Good girls don't join the military. Of course, he was ex-military, you know, during World War II. So I joined anyway, you know. Went to boot camp, went to hospital corps school at Great Lakes, stopped at my folks on the way to San Francisco. I was sitting there one day, and he goes, go put your uniform on. And I looked at him, and I went, what? He goes, go put your uniform on. And I went, okay. So I went in, I put my uniform on, and he goes, come on. He went outside the backyard, stood me in front of his most favorite big rose bush, and took pictures of me in my uniform. I figured, He didn't think it was such a bad idea after all.
So our next storyteller is Gabriel Vannevar, and the title of his story is I Am Hip Hop, Hear Me Rap.
I lost a piece of my soul freshman year of high school. You see, music is the biggest inspiration in my life, and I had this huge collection of rock and roll albums, and it was stolen from me. I had Sublime, Led Zeppelin, Rage Against the Machine, all these great albums that have guided me through my misguided youth were just taken from me. I was devastated. Well, me and my friends had just gotten into breakdancing a little bit, and we're listening to a little hip-hop. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this art form, if I'm going to practice this breakdancing, I really want to learn more about hip-hop. So I forgot about rock and roll for the time being, and I let hip-hop pick me up where rock and roll left off. I did my research, studied the history from, you know, the Sugar Hill Gang, Rakim, Run DMC, to Nas, Biggie, Tupac, Busta Rhymes, all these great guys. They all had such a unique style and flow that really... that really just made them so unique and so inspirational. And well, you know, some of them embellished on misogyny and violence, and well, that was kind of just the surface. And that was something everyone listened to, and the beats were so tight that, you know, I had to listen to it too beyond my moral high ground. So I move with the crowd. There's a lot of misunderstandings about hip-hop. Hip-hop is so much more than just rap. There are so many different elements that create and form this culture of hip-hop. There's DJing, breakdancing, MCing, graffiti writing, and all these styles and forms just come together and create this urban culture. When the DJ scratches on that vinyl crossfading, the B-boys and girls in the place start breaking graph writers, rattle and spray, pretty city settings, MCs, circle and cipher, storytelling. You see, poetry kind of just came... I've always been a lover of poetry, so rap just came naturally to me, you could say. I just started writing, and I just found my voice. And... friends and family thought it was kind of strange, me being this white kid coming from this woodsy folk hippie background, just identifying with this urban identification. But that just fueled my fire even more, and I had to prove them wrong in a sense. And I thought to myself, you know, why can't we all identify with this form of poetry and art? And how do we all expect to get along if we lack this understanding of all art? From all places and all cultures. So my subconscious goal became to spread this understanding of hip-hop and bridge the gap between generations and broaden all those stubborn views, reaching beyond the lackluster commercial society and speak to the roots of all people. I was always fine-tuning my craft. I competed in poetry slams and went to open mics all over New York State and Washington, D.C., and years down the road, I had the honor of teaching spoken word at a workshop for high school, inner city, Washington, D.C. youth. And I'll just say, me and my co-teacher, we stuck out like two white guys at a room full of black kids. And they looked at us like we were some strangers. And I'm like, what do these guys know about rap and spoken word? And well, rather than explain to them that, you know, I'm the teacher, you're the student, I decided to show them my art. And I showed them this poem, Presence. As I sit back, far from the riffraff, my wits graft on this syntax. One joke, kids laugh, one toke, bliss blast, gun smoke, wish cash, unspoken views clash. I wrote this to pass a tick-tock tisk task. To quote the rich or broke, it's impossible to tell what provokes which path. Now I see all the struggle and pain in the paper today. Illegal immigrants are smuggled, taken away. Money God says to comfort the poor walk until their feet hurt, while the wealthy glide by, hovering over the dirt. I feel this overpopulation rocking the tectonic plates. Earth responds with hurricanes, tidal waves, tornadoes, earthquakes. Whatever works, don't believe in fate or lethal injection. Have faith that you are chosen by natural selection. Let the best win, but don't invest in this as a primary lesson. Follow your dreams, don't second guess your instincts. Go where you're destined. And if you ever end up questioning your intentions, know that time can never break, but it can always be bent by your perception. See, since our great inception, we've gone our own direction. As legends leave impressions with a long list of confessions, we beat past the current for the many future blessings and revel in the essence between hell and heaven. So what is the distance between the moon and sun? The difference between zero and one, fear and fun. I walk with these hours as I watch the minutes run, as I'm running in circles in this time-space continuum. A simple symbol similar to some, I rotate my dome a different way to motivate. Then it comes the given sum, the heart's rhythm, the vivid drum beats between what's been done and that which limits none. I sit there stunned. Because you see, they say seasons change through logic and reason, that it'll have you leaving freedom for what you believe in. But if you have that gift to persist and quit dreaming, you might just get a taste if you succeed the preceding presence.
Yeah. So I'm pleased to introduce our next storyteller, who is a member of the North Coast Storytellers Guild. Mary Lawrence is her name, and the title of her story is Summers in Missouri.
Thank you, Allie. It's great to be here this evening and talk about and tell a story about the theme of community. I live in a very small community of Gaskee. I don't know if anyone knows where Gaskee is. It's up in the mountains. And I teach in a little tiny mountain school, and my students are grades K, 1, 2, and 3, all in one room. So thinking about community, I thought about how do children see community? And that led me to think about how I saw community when I was a child. And it made me think back to my Midwestern roots in a little town called Columbia, Missouri, and what community meant to me then, when I was 9 years old. And my community was my home, my family, my little room with my bed and all my toys, and most importantly, it was my backyard where I played with my friends and laughed and cried. And my friends were real, and my friends were also imaginary. There wasn't much to do in my little hometown, especially in the summer. So I'd just lie in my backyard in the grass, and I'd look at my mama's wash drying on the clothesline, and then I'd try to find four-leaf clovers in the grass. Someone had strung up a big trapeze before we'd moved in the backyard, and I'd get up on that trapeze, and I'd swing, and I'd swing, and I'd pretend to be a circus performer. And sometimes I'd pretend that trapeze was an elephant. And I was a beautiful elephant trainer with a sparkly dress and a feather headdress. And the trapeze was my elephant. And my mother would walk by and she'd put her hands on her hips and smile and say, Mary, you've got quite an active imagination. And I did, and I still do. I remember one summer when the sunlight went down and the backyard got really dark. Lightning bugs came out. Has anybody here ever seen a lightning bug? They're magical. They fill the yard with all this light. Well, what I would do is I'd run around and I'd catch lightning bugs in my hand, just like this, being careful not to hurt them. Maybe you did too. And I'd have a big mason jar and I'd cut a piece of paper with scissors in a big circle and I'd put the piece of paper on top of the jar with a big rubber band and I'd cut holes in the top with a scissor blade so they could breathe. And then I'd take them in my room and I'd turn off all the lights, put on my pajamas and put them on my dresser, that big jar full of lightning bugs, and they'd light up and light up and light up. And oh, it was magical. It was so special. Well, this particular night in June, when I was 9, I had a fresh jar of lightning bugs, and I sneaked them in my room because actually my mom didn't know I kept them in there. And I put them on my dresser, and I was just looking at them lighting up and lighting up, and suddenly there was a knock on the door. We were a very polite family. We didn't just barge in. My mother said, "Mary, are you in there?" Well, I just panicked. I didn't want her to see the jar of lightning bugs. So I ran to the window, and I opened it up, and I tore off the top of the lightning bug jar, and I just started pushing those lightning bugs as fast as I could and shaking them so they'd go out. And then I ran back, and I put that under the covers, the jar and me, and I said, "Come on in." Well, my mom came on in, and she said she was getting an extra pillow for my grandma who was coming the next day, and she kissed me goodnight, and I said, "Good night, Mom." And so I put that jar back on the dresser after she left, and as I was looking, I thought maybe there was just one lightning bug back in there, but so I put the top back on with the rubber band so it'd be able to breathe, and I went to sleep. Well, the next morning I woke up, and I fully intended to take that little lightning bug out to the yard, but I looked in the jar, and oh gosh, he looked, well, I thought it was a he, looked so cute that I kind of tapped on the glass, and he started fluttering around and lighting up just like it was nighttime. And I thought, wow, this is so great. I thought, I wonder what it would be like if I shook that jar and put that lightning bug on the palm of my hand. So I shook the jar out, and there was a little bug just right on the palm of my hand, real calm-like. And I kept moving my hand around, and he just was right there. And then all of a sudden, he flew up in the sky and down to my other palm. And he started fluttering back and forth and around my head. And then there he was landing on the dresser again. And I thought, oh, this is so wonderful. I wonder if he's hungry. He's been in the jar all night and in my room. And I wondered what I could feed him. So I'd kept some jelly beans under my pillow. So I took a jelly bean and I put it on the dresser. And well, that little lightning bug started licking it with his little lips and then looking over at me kind of like saying thank you. And this was so exciting. And I thought, well, you know, maybe he's also thirsty. So I went into my bathroom and I got, you know, those little paper cups of water. And I put some water in there and put it by the jelly bean. And he just jumped in and started kind of splashing around like he was taking his morning bath. And oh, it was wonderful. I thought, well, maybe I should go ahead and splash water on my face. So I went in the bathroom and splashed water on my face and got all dressed for the day. And I was feeling a little hungry. So I opened up my bedroom door and I crept into the kitchen, and nobody else was awake. So I got out some orange juice and cereal and milk and sat and ate my breakfast and looked over, and that little critter was sitting right on the table looking up at me. And I thought, well, he just must be a little hungry still. So I took some cereal and I crushed it up in my hand and put it on the table for him to eat. And there he was just eating and looking up at me again. And well, it was time for me to go out and play. So I went out the front door, and wouldn't you know it, he followed me. He was on my shoulder, then he was on my hand. He was kind of fluttering behind me. Well, I went over and played with all my friends, and he was so small that nobody even noticed him. Well, I even went for a swim in a pool, and there he was waiting for me right on the edge of the pool. Well, I don't need to tell you that we soon became fast friends. As a matter of fact, I went in my mom's sewing box, and I fashioned a little leash for him out of some thread. And I wrapped that thread around his little body and left some so that I could hold on. And out we'd go, walking here and there. Oh, we had the best times that summer. And I'd come in the door. He'd be kind of fluttering up and down, ready for his walk. And I'd pat him on his little head. And there we'd go, all around the neighborhood. Oh, that was the best summer ever. Well, me and Buddy, I named him Buddy by now. It was in July. We were lying on the grass, just looking up at the stars. I was teaching him astronomy. And I'd point out the Big Dipper, and he'd just light up, and point out the Little Dipper, he'd light up even more. Oh, that was a magical evening. It was full of lightning bugs, the whole yard. And there was one little lightning bug in particular that kept coming on over and lighting up. Then Buddy would light up, and that lightning bug would light up some more, and Buddy would light up some more. And, well, out of the blue, he flew away. He was nowhere to be seen. I said, "Buddy, Buddy." He was nowhere. Well, tears welled up in my eyes. I thought, well, why did he have to go? We were getting along so nicely. So I looked around, and the yard seemed pretty dark. There were no lightning bugs, and I had to make my way all the way, you know, to my back door. So I, luckily, I'd brought a flashlight with me, so I turned it on, and I started walking towards my house, and out of nowhere, the most beautiful moth landed on my hand. It was huge and gorgeous. The front wings were brown and little black flecks, and the back wings were orange and rimmed with inky black. And I looked down at that moth, and I thought, well, what do you know? And I looked at it, and I said, well, hi, little fella. Do you like jelly beans?
All right, we're going to have another audio clip from Timber Ridge.
I'm Charlotte Moore. I fell off one step. My friend was driving her car to take me home, and I reached out for her car, and I fell right through. On the way down, I thought of all the places I should land on my body so I wouldn't break anything, because I did. I bumps all over the place. But I shredded this artery in my leg. I went to the hospital, take x-rays, and there were no cracks. But then I had to get well and recuperate. So they sent me to a care facility, but it was not adequate to take care of me. So they sent me then to Timber Ridge and was a haven. And there's so much potential here. It's just opportunities are so great. It's so nice to know that we're all protected from elements, the weather and everything, and we have all our needs can be met right here. And this can be and is an example of what could become a great comforting way in the whole United States and the whole world, where people can live their lives in such a way that everything gets better and better and better. And age doesn't have to be a trap. A baby or any age doesn't have to be a trap. We can open the little boxes we tend to put ourselves into by age, and we can grow, keep growing. And I think the future's going to work out ways where everybody's life can be just as happy as mine has been for almost 100 years. I'm 97, and it just seems like it's just went fast. And every period in my life was a learning period. And I think of it as climbing a mountain sometimes when you have problems. But you can climb your mountain, and when you get up there, you get a view that you never had before. And you can do that with all of our problems. We can learn to make the mountains to climb and get a view of life. And I'm proud to be a citizen of the world, the whole planet. We're all together, one community.
One community. My name is Allie Friedland, as if you didn't know that already, and the title of my story is Hairdressers and Ripples. Hairdressers are really good at relationships. Somehow, under their loving hands, those clients tell intimate details of their lives, and somehow that bonds them with the hairdresser, and, well, they can be in friendships that can last years, if not decades. My mother is one of those with the decade category. She went to her hairdresser and still goes to her hairdresser like clockwork once a week. This was the big appointment. It was very, very important that she go and get her hair coiffed before Sunday, before going to church. So she developed these long-term relationships as long as she lived in one place, which before I moved her here was about 34 years, and she still keeps in touch with that hairdresser. Now, hairdressers, hair salons, hairstyles in particular, are as varied as there are flowers on this earth. But my mother, at least according to me, has always had the same hairdo. She thought her hair was too limp, too flat, too thin, and so she went and had it washed and set, which is curled, and then she had it puffed and fluffed and teased and patted and combed and patted again and sprayed. And there was this vaporous cloud of particulate matter, who knows how toxic, would just sort of descend on her, and it would go, and it would stick to her hairdo like a hefty hair helmet. And you knew some of it fell on her chest and on her chin and her lap and shoulders. And, well, I always worried that she might die of overexposure to hairspray. You know, I'm kind of Miss Natural and all that. Well, she's going to turn 93 next week. So I'm obviously wrong in that category. And so since she has this new hairdresser now here in Arcata, it's sort of been a puzzling thing for me because I never had gone to the hairdresser. When I'd go to the hairdresser, and that hairdresser, when I'd pick my mother up, would know more about me than most of my best friends. And I realized all that conversation, all that yakking that went along with the washing and the setting and the styling. What's that connection with the fingertips and the scalp? Well, I don't know. But my mother would always honor this appointment. She was never late. This was important and just fed a loyalty that lasts forever. Well, my mom, in between going from the setting and the styling, had to get her hair dried. And I think most people do who go to the hair salon, get it set anyways. And when at the dryer, however, she was not allowed to talk because this big metal contraption comes down over your head and goes and fries your brain just about. And so she would often read a magazine. Only now she can't read anymore. And she tells me that that has been the biggest loss of her life. And at her age, she's been through a lot of losses, so this is big. The loss of family and friends, the loss of her independence, of being able to have her own home and cook for herself, the loss of even being able to pick herself up when she falls down, the loss of being able to hear conversations. So before she really lost her eyesight, I would take her on drives to look at the views sometimes. And, well, one time we went up to Trinidad. She loved the lighthouse with the ocean in the background. And then we took that road that goes south from Trinidad along those cliffs. And she would exclaim, ah, the cliffs. And then she'd go, oh, this is beautiful. And anyways, because I couldn't, you know, really talk to her in the car without yelling because she couldn't hear me, I decided to talk with her and watch the sunset. And so we parked, and I turned to her and I said, Mom, below us is Luffenholtz Beach. Loving House B? No, Mom. Luffenholtz. Loving Hole? No, Mom, not Loving Hole. Luff and Holtz. Love and Hope. Yes, Mom, that's it. Love and Hope Beach. And that's the way it's going to be for the rest of my mind forever. Sometimes just to make her happy is just the best thing in my life. I live with my mom. I'm not only her daughter, I'm her attendant. So every day she asks me to do chores and tasks, or sometimes I do them myself ahead of her ask. Her needs are growing, and they're like rocks dropped into the pond of my life. And anymore, it's not just the disturbance of that rock. It's those ripples, the rings, the circular rings of love and light that move out in her profound appreciation of me. And then sometimes I watch the rock as it falls through the water column of my life and goes down until it settles in the depths of me. And I realize that my capacity to give has gotten so much larger, and I'm grateful. But there are still things that I cannot give, and one of them is a good hairdo. So every week, like clockwork, we bundle her up, as painful as it is, and she puts on another nice piece of jewelry and maybe a nice shirt, and we take her to Patty. And Patty welcomes her with loving arms and conversation and lots of hairspray every single Friday at 10:30 sharp. Thank you. Great. So our next storyteller, Sister Soul, she's got an incredible story to tell. And the title of her story is Testing 1, 2, 3.
Life is but a dream. Life is but a dream. Do-do-do-do-shaboom. When I was a kid growing up in the South Bronx, almost all the fellas did some a cappella singing on the street corner. Music in my neighborhood could be heard on the record player, the jukebox, and always on the radio. I'll bet most of you could name at least one radio DJ who made you feel real, like they even understood you somehow. For me, it was master DJs like Alan Freed, known as Moondog, or Symphony Sid, jumping with my boy Sid in the city. Jocko Henderson, E diddy up. Ho, this is Jock, and I'm back on the scene with the record machine. Correct time now, 9:15. And then the only woman DJ I'd ever heard, Allison Steele, called herself the Nightbird. The Nightbird played great music on WNEW back in the early 70s, but she did other things to make her show special, like reading poetry. And one night, she read this poem titled The Mask, and it spoke about the many faces we wear throughout our lives, or something like that, and I wanted that poem. So I took a chance, and I wrote to her asking about it. And in a few days' time, there was that poem in my mailbox. Now, who would have imagined that this unseen lady, with her soothing voice coming out of my bedside radio, would do that for me? You know, as a kid, I used to wonder, how did someone get to be a disc jockey? Was there some very special school? Was there a test? Well, in 1981, while a student at Humboldt State, I got my own radio show on KHSU. No special school, no test, just a love of music and the desire to share it. And over the years, I'd get some nice fan mail, always enjoyable. And then, about 23 years ago, I got my first of many fan letters from a most unexpected location. This communique came from T, a prisoner at the now infamous Pelican Bay State Prison. And believe it or not, from then on, he would write me every week and I reciprocated. Now, I'm not shy about writing the folks who end up in prison. Heck, I once spent an evening in the women's house of detention. It's true. There are so many stories I could tell you from all of those letters. In addition to the story of T and me, let me share a little about two other guys I've come to know. First, there's Donnie. He was in solitary for decades. I know his mother. It would break your heart. But the amazing thing about Donnie was his ability to create art like that of Jackson Pollock. He painted the most colorful abstracts imaginable. Now, you know, men in solitary are not allowed crayons, colored pencils, nothing. So Donnie would water down those delicious colored M&Ms, red, yellow, blue, green, so as to create color. And he'd use his hair as his brush. Then there's Brown Indian. He writes me every week, tracks all the songs I play, and then provides commentary. Hey, sis, that song was on fire. You're mine and we belong together. My mom played that one all the time. Now, getting back to T, you know, the guy who wrote me that very first letter. He sent this heartfelt message after picking up a faint radio signal. And that night, I was playing lots of Marvin Gaye. He said my music reminded him of home. T was in the very first group of inmates selected to serve time in this new Supermax prison. And that's when my prison education began in earnest. First thing I learned about was solitary confinement, where humans are locked up in tiny 8x10 windowless concrete tombs, where food, otherwise known as slop, is slipped in through a tiny slat in a non-see-through door, and people would be in these miserable cells for 22 and 23 hours a day, sometimes for decades. Luckily for T, his stay in solitary was short. After I got T's first letter, his cellie at the time assured him that that lady was never going to write him back once she saw the return address. But I did exactly what the nightbird would have done. And that one letter forever changed our lives. As long as the prison was not on lockdown, T would call and write me every week, as I told you. The call sounds like this. This call is from an inmate at Pelican Bay State Prison. To accept, press, or say five. I do both. Well, after a few years into our friendship, I raised the idea to T about coming to live with my husband and me when he gets out. He thought I was crazy. He explained with great certainty, sis, maybe one, maybe two people a year who have a life sentence with the possibility of parole ever get to go home. And I said, well, T, why can't you be that one? And in that moment, something changed. As the years turned into decades, T and I would dream about his release and the things he would do. He'd finish his college degree. He'd get a contractor's license, or he could teach fitness classes. T is one of the lucky ones, if you can call ending up in prison lucky. See, he has folks out here in his corner. In prison, he became a very skilled carpenter and even taught himself how to draw blueprints. So when he gets out, he will build a well-thought-out and superbly constructed dwelling on our property. Did I tell you he was 17 when he entered the system? He's 45 now. Well, the good news is, and I mean this, he is finally going to be released. Now, sometimes dreams actually do come true, And something in us truly believes this. And you want to know something? I am sure that it was the radio, that simple device that most of us still embrace, with me behind the microphone and T hearing my voice, my songs, that inspired him to take a chance and write this DJ a letter, never imagining it might someday lead to his freedom. And maybe, just maybe, the Nightbird would somehow know up there in DJ heaven what her kind gesture to me decades ago set in motion. Life is but a dream, life is but a dream. Do, 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 shaboom.
Wow, what a diverse variety of stories. So I have to tell you, the Word has been funded through grants from the California Arts Council Creating Public Value, the Ivy Irene Hughes and Carl G. Lundgren funds, both funds of the Humboldt Area Foundation. So now there will be a 15-minute intermission. Please come back.
Here for the band, the Randalls, LeBol, Amar Khan. Thanks, everybody, and thanks here for the storytellers in the first half. My name's Jeff DeMarc. I used to drive a yellow taxi for Union Cab Company in Madison, Wisconsin. That's right. And when you're driving a taxi, it's all about quickness and quantity. You got to get people in and out of that cab and to their destination as fast as you can, pick someone else up, get them in, get them there, get the money, load them out, load in, load out, wash, rinse, repeat, load in, load out. That's what the job is all about. So you'd always have about a 3 or 4 hour window of opportunity to make your bread from maybe 4 to 7:30. After that, it was just picking up strays at the airport or people coming out of the bars or something. So in that 3 or 4 hour time, you got very, very buzzed up and manic, and you could really get into a very strange state of mind. And there were times if I got slowed down or something bothered me, I could truly understand why Robert De Niro had that mohawk and that crazy look on his face when he was a cab driver. Now, if something slowed you down, you could really get out there. And there was this one fare named Gladys. Very nice woman, elderly woman. But if you got Gladys, you knew that your night had just taken a turn into the very slow lane. Now, normally, you'd get a call, you'd drive up, person would come in. But with Gladys, you'd have to park your cab, go into her apartment, up the elevator, knock on her door. There she'd be standing, this really wonderful woman, nice smile, this is her big day out. And you'd have to do this. You put your arm out, she'd take and put her purse on it. Then you would take and get her walker. Then she would grab your arm, and you would begin walking down the hallway in the most tiniest, most minuscule, slowest steps in the history of mankind. Down the elevator, then you would start crab walking out to the cab, get to the cab, load her in, and then you would drive to her favorite cafe, which was a mile away. It would be a $1.65 fare, 15-cent tip. It would take 45 minutes. So you knew that your night was not going to be the big bucks night you were hoping for. So this one Friday night, rush hour, buzzing around, I particularly needed money this weekend. All of a sudden, the dispatcher says the coordinates, Monona and Thor. Everybody knows it's Gladys. All the cab drivers start running away from the call as fast as they can. They're like a bunch of cats when a door slams. The dispatcher goes, Monona and Thor. Nothing. Monona and Thor, anybody working out there? So then he knows what's happening, and he tries to smoke us all out. Now, you could never lie to the dispatcher about your where you actually were. 22, where are you? 26, 31, 35, where are you? 38, where are you? That was me. Looks like you got the call, 38, 2326 Thor Avenue, GIFG. And I said, what the hell does that mean? He says, go in for Gladys. And, oh, man, why did I get into this cab driving life, this lone ranger, lone wolf life? Oh, man. Oh. So I drive to her place, go up the elevator, knock on Gladys' door. There she is standing there, her hair done up perfectly, in her nicest spring coat. She's got a vase of tulips on the table. This is her big night out. She looks at me and says, so nice to see you on this beautiful spring night. And I take one look at her and I think, what the hell is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? This is what a cab driver does. You pick up old people, drunk people, poor people, people who can't walk, whatever it is. This is the nature of the job. And I thought, if I can't go in for someone like Gladys, I should just quit right now. And right there, I came up with this epiphany that's kind of carried through my life. Sometimes you gotta go in for Gladys. Because someday, you could be Gladys yourself. No matter what job it is, no matter what you're doing, you just got to stop your whining and bitching and GIFG, go in for Gladys. Thank you. I'm making bumper stickers up like that. The next story is Gene Doran. It's called The Stupidest Thing I Ever Did.
My name is Gene Doran, but once it was Gene Mortensen, and I was a student in college, and I did the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life at that time. Would you like to hear about it? I was sitting in my dormitory on the deck, and these guys I knew came by, and these guys said, hey, you know what we did last night? I said, no. He said, we climbed the M Street Bridge, the tallest bridge in Sacramento. And I said, that sounds like fun. What a stupid statement, because all of a sudden I was in their car driving over to the bridge. And I got there and I saw this ladder. They said, that's how you get up. And I kicked off my shoes and one at a time, rung over rung, I went over this ladder, no problem, right up to the tip top of the bridge. And I made the terrible mistake of looking down. And I saw these tiny little cars on the bridge and these tiny little boats in the water of the Sacramento River. And guess, I froze. I just don't know how I was at the top of this bridge, but I just couldn't go anywhere. And then I got in my mind, I saw a picture of the headline in the Sacramento Bridge that said, co-ed saved from bridge. And didn't say what was in the water or where. But I could see that and my folks reading it and thinking, oh my God. And that's what I thought, oh my God, I've got to get down. I've got to turn around and back and find the rung of the ladder and then start down. And that's what I did. I went one rung at a time, backwards, feeling for the next one down. And when I got down, the fellows were there, and they got my shoes, and we got in the car, and we drove back Davis. We never said anything. We never told anybody. It wasn't a thing to brag on. It was something I felt was the stupidest thing I ever did.
Great story. Next storyteller is Maggie Gaynor, and she's going to tell her story, My Moment at the Muni.
Thank you. I want to dedicate my story to Alex and Wesley and all the young people over the years that have asked me for career advice. On Tuesday, April 12th, 1977, U.S. Representative Phil Burton from San Francisco and two other members of the House Subcommittee on Park Expansion flew over the Tall Trees Grove, Emerald Creek, and other parts of Redwood National Park in an Army helicopter. It was big news. The next day started out for me like every other work day. I listened to the radio as I drove to work, and Casey and the Sunshine Band played I'm Your Boogeyman, and ABBA sang Dancing Queen. I remember 1977 as kind of the peak year in 70s disco and ugly fashions, and I was dressed up for work in my polyester and clunky shoes like everybody else I knew. I was 25, and I'd only lived in Humboldt for 3 years, and I was fascinated by all things Redwood Country. It was so different from the Appalachia and Midwest of my childhood. And back there, the economy was going through a really painful transition with changes in industry and agriculture. Factories were closing and tons of people were out of work. It was being called the Rust Belt, and it was really no place to be for a new college graduate. So I was just one of the hordes of young boomers who packed up our hopes and dreams and headed out west to find more opportunity. I got a job at Redwood National Advertising Agency on South Broadway in Eureka. My boss was a real entrepreneur and mover and shaker in the Eureka business community. He owned several businesses along South Broadway, and he was kind of a hard ass. But on that morning, he had the managers call all the employees together, and they announced to us that we were going to get to have most of the day off so that we could participate in a rally and a march to a public hearing held by Congressman Burton about the proposed expansion of Redwood National Park. So we all headed over to the courthouse, and when we got there, the excitement was just getting started. You could see people streaming in from every direction, the main streets, alleys, side streets, parking lots, and we all were gathering on the front lawn of the courthouse. And there we listened to the fiery anti-park speeches of Eureka Mayor Sam Sacco, Congressman Don Clausen, a few of the members of the Board of Supervisors, and other community leaders. And then they handed to each one of us picket signs, a whole array of messages, things like ship Burton and Brown to Japan, trees are renewable resource, jobs are not, And so with our picket signs, then we all followed the speakers in a march to the Eureka Municipal Auditorium. It's important to understand that besides the big economic and political issues surrounding this, the regular working people of Humboldt County were really afraid of changes in their way of life forever. For generations, they'd been able to earn a good living working in the woods, working in the local mills, supporting their families, and everybody knew that park expansion meant a lot of people were going to lose their jobs. So by the time we had marched the 10 blocks to the Muni, the crowd had gotten really pumped up. It was much larger and much louder and much hotter. It was a warm and sunny day in Eureka, and we were all sweating in our polyester suits, and I had screaming blisters. More than 2,000 people packed into the Muni. The entire horseshoe-shaped balcony was filled, and every single seat on the main floor was filled. By the time my friends and I got there, there was just barely enough room for us to squeeze in the front door and stand. And this was a big event for Eureka in 1977. They set up the hall for the public hearing with a long row of tables and several microphones for the congressmen. And then right in front of them was a table with two mics for our local speakers. And one by one, the speakers, local employers, union reps, elected officials, and lumber company executives were called one by one to explain their positions up at the microphones about how expansion of Redwood National Park would irreparably damage our economy. And with every speaker, the crowd would cheer and applaud like a big sports pep rally. And then finally it was time for the last two speakers that were called, and they were the representatives from Arcata City Council. As they made their way to the front of the hall for their turn at the microphones, everything changed. The crowd hissed and booed and hit them with spitballs. And everyone stood and stomped and shouted in unison, "Boycott Arcata! Boycott Arcata! Boycott Arcata!" It was deafening. And for me, just a few years earlier, I had been a student in Ohio participating in anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. And when the crowds got this intense is when they brought out the tear gas in the clubs. So I was queasy and really on edge. But I was also really curious. I wanted to know what those people from Arcata were going to say. So I left my friends, and I twisted and turned and bumped my way through the tight crowd so that I could get up closer and actually hear and see. And I actually got very close, and I was right behind a curtain, and I could look right over. I could actually see the beads of sweat on the mayor and council member from Arcata on their foreheads. I could see the intensity and resolve in their eyes as they spoke in favor of Redwood National Park expansion. And I was struck by their courage to speak the truth of their convictions, surrounded by such a hostile crowd. We all have turning points in our lives, and if we're lucky, they're those moments that bring extreme clarity and a strong sense of direction. And in that moment that I listened to them speak, I had two epiphanies. I had a twofer. The first epiphany was that I had traveled so far away from all my family and my friends to escape the hard economic conditions back in Ohio. And here I am in my new home that I love so much, dealing with some very similar issues. The second and even more important epiphany was in that moment, I found my calling, I decided my career path, and I made a commitment that I wanted to be a part of the hard work ahead of bringing people together, not pitting them against each other, but bringing people together to create new kinds of jobs. I knew that I would never forget my friends, their fear and anguish and worry about job security and how they were going to support their families. But I was equally certain that I was committed to be a part of the future of creating the kinds of jobs that can protect and repair natural resources and actually benefit the environment. Thank you.
Now we're going to listen to Louise Kretner Wallen Peterson's story, I Remember.
I'm Louise Kretner Wallen Peterson, and I remember the house where I was born. It had a great big kitchen that was always warm. There was a wood stove on one side and a couch by the window and a table that was just right for eight. I remember laying on the couch on the cold and winter days while my mother sewed and mended or crocheted. I remember laying there listening to the kettle sing. It was such a wonderful feeling, but I remember.
This is Marianne Mayday, and her story is Beneath Our Feet.
I began my journey on the flanks of the South Fork Mountain, basking in the sun, with my hundreds of rock brothers and my thousands of sisters of sand. That is, until the rains came and washed all of us rocks and cobbles and gravel and sand down the hill slope and plunged us into the mad river below. There we were pushed and pulled and flipped and rolled and jumbled and tumbled down past the rapids at Maple Creek, down past the Big Bend at Blue Lake, down past the cows grazing on the Arcata Bottoms, out to the ocean. No rest there, though. Up and down, back and forth, we were tossed about until a powerful wave plucked me up and threw me onto the strand. The strand, this beautiful sliver of land between the ocean and the sand dunes. One can hear the waves crash, but be protected from their strength. The air is full of the smell of salt and even the faint fragrance of feathery yarrow from above. The strand is the gateway to the complex world of the sand dunes, my new home. The gentle leaves of the yellow sand verbena catch me, and I nestle at its roots for a while. From here, I get the perspective of this delicate dance between the plants and the sand. You see that beach strawberry there? It sends its tendrils out onto the sand sheet. Sometimes they root and start to grow. Other times, it gets whipped away by the sand and the wind. There's a mat of seaside daisy, beach pea, goldenrod. Sometimes it gets covered by the sand. Other times, the flowers form a carpet and protect the sand from blowing in the wind. Then the sand shifts, and the plants respond again. Back and forth, advance, retreat. Somehow that pattern is always changing, but the same from year to year. I love it when the wool carder bee visits. In the spring, after the male has his fling, he flees away. But the mother bee meticulously makes an individual sand nest for each egg that she lays. But a sand nest isn't enough. At the same time, the beach buckwheat sends up this spike of an eye-catching pink flower. And at its base is low-lying leaves covered with a soft fuzz. That mother bee goes and scrapes off the fuzz, brings it back to her nest, and makes a nice cozy home for each of those eggs. So it really takes a buckwheat village to raise a bee. Such life on the dunes. What looks like a plain brown mound of soil, on closer inspection, is really squiggling, writhing, wriggling, swarming with ants. Thousands of ants. Not the little black sugar ants that find their way onto your kitchen table, but giant cinnamon brown ants that are swarming around, scurrying, making this big warm thatch hut for their queen and her eggs. They speak, but not with words, but with smells. They have over 30 different scents to tell them where to feed or who to fight. As the wind blows me across the dunes, I come across an area that's very different from the place I was before. I've never been one much to stomach bullies, but here there's a husky European beach grass called Ammophila that's invaded the neighborhood. Like a Genghis Khan, it's smothered the plants, it's shackled the sand beneath its feet. What was once a mosaic of purples and whites and yellows and pinks has been transformed into this dingy Ammophila ghetto. Like a gang, the grasses are staking out their territory and expanding and pushing out the residents there who are more diverse but also vulnerable. But all of a sudden I hear laughter. Laughter of people from Blue Lake, from Manila, from Arcata, from the Creamery District. They're here to help remove that bully Ammophila. Armed with gloves and shovels, they're going to dig out the grass and help restore the dunes. They stand at the crest of the dunes for a moment to look at the work that needs to be done. Then they slip and slide down the dune face to get to their work site, kicking up the sand and whoosh! Here I go again.
Our next storyteller is Kiernan Powers, and she's telling her story, Mind Over Matter.
Several years ago, I was living in Eugene, Oregon with my family. I was a hypnotherapist, and I loved taking workshops. Well, one day, I called a colleague up in the Seattle area to sign up for a workshop that she was going to be hosting. Sherry's her name. And she also said that, why don't I just spend the weekend with her at her house? Perfect. 2 weeks later, on a Friday in October, I was driving up to a small town outside of Seattle, and where Sherry lived with her husband, Tom. They greeted me. It was already dark. We chatted for a while like old friends. And then I settled myself into the classroom space up above the garage to sleep. It was a large open room with thick blue carpet and windows on three sides, quite comfy. The next morning when I awoke, I was able to really appreciate the beauty of the surroundings. Looking out the back window, the view was of a nearby lake and in the distance, majestic snow-capped mountains. I also noticed a large pile of wood in the backyard. And then when I went downstairs to the kitchen, Sherry greeted me with an incredible invitation. She was going to be leading a self-empowerment seminar that evening that was going to culminate in a fire walk. She had already checked in with the group and had the thumbs up if I wanted to join. Wow. Walking on hot coals was not on my list, and I had to think about this for a minute. And I felt a bit awkward joining this group of RE/MAX realtors. I had done my share of MLM sales, and I knew what it was like to be in a group of hyped-up salespeople. On the other hand, this was a unique opportunity and an extraordinary way of facing fear. It didn't take me too long to figure out I just had to say yes. After my workshop day, about 20 highly motivated salesmen and women gathered to experience mind over matter. The room was buzzing with anticipation and excitement as we sat in a big circle having dinner. I felt a bit shy, but I got caught up in the enthusiasm of the group. Then Sherry shared some history on the firewalking tradition, which was and still is practiced in many cultures for various reasons. Some of what I remember is the oldest written record of a firewalk was from India, and it was dated back 4,000 years. It was the account of two Brahmin priests who were competing to see who could walk on fire the farthest. No lack of ego there. In Rome, citizens could actually be exempt from paying their taxes if they could demonstrate the ability to walk on fire without burning. And in Bali and Africa, fire dancing was and still is used as a powerful healing ritual. Sherry said that in 1977, two things happened that brought firewalking from obscurity into the modern world. One was that there was an article published in Scientific American that was essentially a how-to guide for firewalk. And the second was a man named Tolly Birkin experienced a firewalk, and he recognized this was a very powerful personal growth tool. He proceeded to teach as many people as he could the body-mind connection and how to harness the power of the mind to walk on coals that were exceeding 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Next, Sherry passed out 12 by 12 by 1-inch boards. On the top, we wrote our limiting beliefs, and on the bottom, we wrote our goals. In the center of the circle were two columns of cinder blocks, and as each of us felt inspired, we walked to the center and put our board bridging those blocks. Now, this exercise took laser-like focus and intention to move through our limitations to our goals, martial arts style, a throwback to karate class. When I felt ready, I took my turn. I took my board, I went into the circle, I placed the board very carefully, raised my arm, and thwack! I broke that board in two, and I had a souvenir of my empowerment. And if the evening had ended there, I would have been happy. But no, those realtors were on fire, and they were ready to achieve the impossible. Their voices were getting loud and a bit giddy, and it was time to go outside, where Tom had been performing the role of firekeeper for the past few hours. Now, he had started with a wall of wood, that wood that I noticed in the back. The wall was about 4 foot high and about 15 feet long. And from a blazing fire, he created a bed of coals about 8 feet wide and about 20 feet long. This being the Seattle area, it was cool and damp, so the heat from the coals actually had a comfortable campfire feeling. And I was thinking, well, if my feet are cold enough and wet enough, maybe it'll be easier to walk on this marshmallow toasting material. I started to seriously question if I was really going to do this thing, knowing that if I had any doubt in my mind, there were dire consequences. All around me, I hear chants of, if I can do this, I can do anything. And we're the hottest realtors in Seattle. And we believe we can do it. The first person walks, and there's an explosion of cheering and hooting and hollering, and lots of hugs for the celebrant. Each walk brings more highly charged reaction. I'm going along with this cheering and thinking it looks pretty easy and nobody's been burnt yet. My mind is starting to go blank. I'm in a trance, and time has stopped. After most of the participants have already walked, something takes over my body, and I'm standing at the edge of this red-hot pathway to personal transformation. I feel the heat. I hesitate a moment, and then I am walking quickly with the sound and sensation of hot popcorn under my feet, all warm and crunchy. I keep my vision way out past the goals, never looking down. My mind goes blank. I have no peripheral vision. I am in an altered state of mind, to be sure. And then I step back onto the cool grass, and I feel a rush of incredible lightness, as though I have left fear behind. My heart is racing, and it seems like I can feel every blade of grass under my feet as several people embrace me. And my first thought is, I wonder what my kids are going to think about this. Well, years later, when I first moved to Humboldt with my family, we were camping at Patrick's Point one cold gray August. I went shopping at the co-op, and on the bulletin board, I noticed a flyer announcing a fire walk. Well, my husband, my four kids, and I, we all said yes, and now we all have our fire walk story. Thank you.
Here's a newcomer to the Playhouse, Jackie Dandino, and her story, Working Towards a Fragrant Whole.
Thank you. So it's springtime, and it is the time of lilacs. And when I was walking out in Blue Lake, there's this lilac bush that my neighbor has, and it has such an amazing smell. And instantly, I was transported backwards in time to a small farm in rural Alberta, a farm between Spruce Grove and Edmonton, and a giant lilac tree that grew in our yard that the smell would overcome anything. It's springtime, and the silage pit that was melting over in the corner could not compete with the lilac bush. The cow manure in the pasture that was just melting could not compete with my lilac bush. And I would go under there, and I had this little fort under the lilac bush, and it was heaven. And this one day, I was lying under the lilac bush, and my mom called out, Jackie, come on, we gotta go. And I realized it was Friday, and it was bingo at the Elks Hall. So I went in and I got dressed with my mom and dad, and I got in the station wagon. We all got in the station wagon. My dad drove us the 5 miles to town over the gravel roads, and we got to Spruce Grove to the Elks Hall, and my mom and dad had a key. So we went in and we opened the door, and the smell that greeted me was wood, polished wood, and natural gas from the stove in the kitchen, and dance chalk. And there was this giant elk on the wall that was stuffed. And I knew I was so afraid of it, because when I was in tap dancing, I could never be in the front row in Mrs. Moore's tap class. I always had to be at the back, because that thing freaked me out. But I was a little older now, so I could suck it up and go help my dad. We pulled the bingo machine out of the back, and we set up tables, and we got all ready in chairs. And my mom and I went over, and we set up the snack bar. All my favorite chocolate bars, Crispy Crunch, Crunchy, Smarties, oh yes, Old Dutch potato chips, Hawkins, Cheesies, and Pop. It was heaven on a stick. My job was to be in charge of the daubers, and they came in little white bottles with handy grips on them. There was purple, there was red, there was blue, and there was green, and I would line them up just so, so that when people came, they could buy their daubers. Well, people started arriving, and my mom would sell them candy, and she would rip off a big sheet, a big newspaper sheet that had all the bingo cards on it, and there were six bingo cards on each sheet of newspaper. And I was here, but I was like down underneath the counter because I was too young to be at bingo. That was illegal in rural Alberta. So I was underneath the counter, and I would watch my mom give these sheets away. And then just as the game was about to start, my mom would rip one off and give it to me. And I had my purple dauber, and I was ready to go. So I would listen. My dad would call the bingo, and he'd had the machine with like the little, and he'd pick the ball up and he'd say, under the B, three. And in from my perch underneath the counter, I could picture Mrs. Shenfield. She had eight sheets. That is 48 cards, people. She had her lucky rabbit's foot in one hand. She had her dauber in the other. Done. And I'm like just trying to get through, you know, the first card. And then my dad calls out, under the N, 32. And I look over, and there's my mom, and there's her legs and her head up there, and I just think, does it get any better than this? And then under the eye, 16, and I look at my card, and I am so close, my illegal bingo game of four corners, I am going to win this puppy, I'm going to win, and then what am I going to do? And the cigarette smoke hangs thickly in the air, and it kind of stings my eyes, but I don't care, because I smell victory. There is pause, there is tension in the air, and then under the O, 64, bingo! That's it. Rumpling of paper. Everybody takes their thing. They come. They buy more papers. And so it goes over the night, bingo game after bingo game after bingo game, and I never win. And then at the end of the night, everybody comes, and they stack their chairs up, and they move them over to the side of the Elks Hall, and they go home. And my mom and dad and I put the tables away, and we put the bingo machine behind, and we're sweeping. And then suddenly I am transported forward many years to a small town in Arcata, in California, and I realized that this seed, this need to organize and create space for my community to come together, has been planted inside me for a long time. And I realized that I really do believe that together we are stronger, and I've learned that from my parents. And so when I go and I see that lilac, and I see all those small flowers working together towards that fragrant whole, I put it in a vase in the middle of my table. Thank you. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. It's been a great evening. I just want to channel Amy Goodman for a little bit here so I can thank everybody. This is NPR. This is public radio. So here I go. Yes, I'd like to thank Jan Bramlett, Gail Capso, Jody Rowland, A.O.K., Gabriel Vannevar, Carol Wolf, Mary Lauren, Charlotte Moore, Allie Freeland, Sister Soul, Jeff DeMark, Jane Doran, David Fernie, Tullivan, Megan, Maggie Gaynor, Lewis Kretner, Wallen Pearson, Mary Ann, Mayday, Residents of Timber Ridge, Kieran Pounds, Jackie Dana, Paul Woodland, Lauren Axelrod, Tim Gray, Chardon Store, Tim Randall, Guy, Millie Mary, Mike LaVol, Bob Amerkan, Josh, Katie, Dave, Matt, Ed, KHSU, California Arts Council, Creating Public Value, Irene Hughes and Carl Under, and both funds of the Humboldt Area Foundation, the Arcata Playhouse, all the storytellers. Thank you very much. Now, if we can get all the storytellers back on stage, let's give them one big more round of applause. A special thanks to Allie Friedland and Lauren Axelrod for shepherding these stories forward. Good job, everybody.
And to our Allie, who was special in bringing us all together.
Yay, thank you. Allie. Very nice. And now, back to KHSU's regular programming.